Welcome to the roundtable panel for this morning. It is Wednesday, August 20th. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue. You can find the playlist for the show, today's music by Yola Tango, playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. Our panelists this morning on this rainy, but we needed the rain, so no one's complaining in this. My mic just ran away from my mouth in a way that has never happened before. So even the microphone says, don't you complain about this rain, and I wasn't going to. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Good rainy morning, everybody. And our panelists are public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Bob Griffin, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. Good morning, everybody. How are you all?
Good morning. Wet.
Yes.
But not complaining.
Not complaining.
Actually, today is National Radio Day.
Ooh.
So, special call out. And I just want to point out the importance of radio, particularly in times of totalitarianism, as a beacon of freedom and truth. So, as you listen to the show, realize and think about the importance of what radio has meant to our communities and how important it is moving forward.
Happy National Radio Day to all of our listeners and members. And as Bob is pointing out, the support for public radio always required, and you can give anytime at WAMC.org. This is not a fundraising day, just since it is National Radio Day, it couldn't hurt to mention. How are you, Nick? It's been a minute. You've been busy this summer.
Oh, yeah, we are always busy. We were just talking about all the many ways that nonprofit organizations are spending a lot more time discussing and following and responding to changes in the funding landscape across the country. But our organization, we're gearing up for our annual Justice for All Awards in October, October 22nd. It'll be held in Saratoga at the Canfield. And if people are interested in what we have going on, they should visit our website, lasney.org. We have actually the author of Change the Wallpaper. There was a guest on WAMC a few months ago, Nalajana Dasgupta, and her book was released earlier this year, and I got to chat with her in this little interview, and she's fantastic, and she's coming in to do our keynote, so we're really, really excited to chat with her, too.
Say your website again.
Lasney.org, LASNNY.org.
Great. And the date of the awards?
It's October 22nd.
Fantastic. LASSNY.org. Lots to talk about today, as every day. I wanted to get specifically all of your opinions, but specifically Bob's opinion on the recent conversations in Alaska and D.C. yesterday with the Coalition of the Willing regarding the Russo-Ukraine war. As we know, members of the Coalition of the Willing have been meeting in D.C. after the summit between President Donald Trump and President Vladimir Putin in Alaska last week. Just some comments on recent events from our Homeland Security, et cetera, specialist.
It's grim. What's both heartening and disheartening at the same time is watching other world leaders, folks that I would have categorized as long-term allies of ours, where we were in lockstep on foreign policy, actually moving away from the United States. That's the bad part of it, the fact that our leadership globally, I think, has suffered significant, and it's harm that can be repaired, Sarah, but it's going to take a long time to rebuild trust. The bad part is, you know, the good part is that they're supporting Ukraine and continuing to show at least a modicum of support for what is occurring in the Ukraine against the Russian aggression. But there's just a big gap. I've been looking at a lot of articles about how the Ukraine military has had to change how it's approaching the war, how Russia has increased the severity in targeting of civilian populations as they think And unfortunately, I think it was confirmed by Trump that we're backing out on our commitment to the Ukraine. So I see that whole situation as sort of both a positive in the sense that if I was as a supporter of the Ukraine, I'm glad to see that there are people who are strong enough to come out and say, even in the face of Trump's bullying, no, we're going to stand on the side of what is right and what is just. I question, where is this country? Where are we going with our foreign policy? Frankly, I was embarrassed by what I saw out of Alaska. I was embarrassed by the symbolism. We got played as a country. We looked much weaker than we should have. The relationship between Putin and Trump is one that is of enormous concern because of the practices that Trump admires that Putin used. And I think as we talk about some of the other issues today, whether it's the use of the military in our cities, whether it's the abject cruelty of an administration who is spending a lot of time figuring out how to be even crueler, these are all sort of, in my mind, symptoms of movement of government towards totalitarianism and authoritarianism that we need, as a country, need to stand up against.
Nick or Teresa, any questions, comments, feedback on the?
Yeah, I echoing what Bob said, I think that it was a real yet more evidence of the Trump team, and I wouldn't say we. I think we have to say it's the Trump team. I understand it's on behalf of our country, but this has to be laid on them and on the Republicans in Congress who enable it and who continue the funding of it and don't put any checks, because the Republicans in the Congress could put some checks on what's happening, and they're not doing it. But I think that it was a real sign, and if you listen to historians, diplomats, generals who talked about it, there was a chorus of consensus, and even in Fox News, of it being a display of weakness and a display of concern, what Trump and his team did, from what was talked about. But even, I mean, there was a lot of talk about the finding the documents in a hotel office, but you know,
right, on a printer,
business office on a printer. That's not a small thing, to be honest with you. That's because if these folks don't understand the seriousness of the situation and that they are so untrained that they use a public computer and a public printer in these highly classified, some people say it's just a memo. Well, it was a memo, but a menu. It was that and much more. It's just a level of lack of understanding of the seriousness and a focus on performance and not a focus on substance. And it has carried over into the follow-on talk about, you know, from the Trump on down, his commerce folks, and why are they not the diplomats talking, saying, oh, now the next step is we have to have a meeting with Putin and Ukraine. And no, what the leaders, what we need to have is the hard work of their people, the diplomats, the generals, the military folks, talking to work out some sort of a detail. They're skipping the governing part. It's a lot like Trump just signing executive orders and think that's governing. That's not doing the hard work of governing. And again, you see it across the board. And it really weakens the U.S. standing in the world. And I do think that you did see some evidence of the importance of the foundation of the President Biden did in terms of pulling together the coalition, the NATO coalition, because they really have come to the rescue. And it was so important, them essentially inviting themselves to the White House, saying they were coming. And I think that show of support and saying that they were not going to let Zelensky come alone and be subject to what he was the last time. But that's a terrific display of the power of the NATO coalition. But also, it's a really damning comment on Trump and his team's approach to this, that they feel that they needed to do that. And Trump was talking about how historic it was. It was, but in a really concerning way. And I think that they just, you know, we had been the leader of the free world, and I think that they're just not operating at that level at across the board, whether it's on the tariff negotiations, whether it's on budget negotiations, whether it's on Ukraine or what's happening in Gaza, which I think the reporters have to go back to asking what's happening in Gaza, because it's continuing to get worse. People are continuing to starve, and now you hear the reports today, the ongoing reports of the Israelis' plans to move over 1 million people into a settlement area and then eventually out of the country in a year-long additional offensive there. And these are funded with our dollars. I mean, there's a lot of deeply unsettling things going on, and China's watching, folks. China's watching.
Nick?
Yeah, so just to circle back on the sort of the meeting with Russia and with Ukraine and allies, I think what stands out to me is the lack of expertise and experience, right, and the depth or the lack thereof, depth of knowledge of the team that is staffing the U.S. president in both those conversations, those negotiations, and in international diplomacy. And I think that's a reflection on this backlash against deep state, if you will, the notion that deep knowledge and expertise is somehow a barrier to creative problem solving, right? And the notion that the people who have been career diplomats, career negotiators, career political thinkers and political thought leaders have been purged from this administration and from DC and from our agencies, are the agencies that are supposed to be able to keep us safe. And the fact is that lack of information, lack of knowledge means that then we rely on something else. And what we relied on in this instance was a performative image in which we did not have enough information to bring a real option or real solutions to the table, but instead rolled out the red carpet, had a military presence, had the media there to make Putin look good, allowed Putin to take his wins, which was a photograph with the president and these images where the president is looking less than the machismo image that he's accustomed to being presented as. And that is, you know, it is that there was this embarrassment because of how poorly many people think the meeting went with President Putin, but also just we have to recognize that it went poorly because there's not a depth of expertise there who could have made it go differently.
Or wouldn't have set it up in the first place, because progress was unlikely to occur. It does not seem like Putin will.
Well, what's the goal? I mean, you're hitting, ever. I think, part of my frustration. What's the goal of this? And in the back of my mind, the goal is Trump's desire to get a Nobel Peace Prize, regardless of what is right, just, or correct, both for our country but also for the Ukraine. And the history that I see with this guy is that it's always about him. So I'm looking at this from a lens of, am I opposed to peace in the Ukraine? No, I'm not opposed at all. But the idea that somehow we are going to be party to strong-arming the Ukraine to give up more territory, you know, which frankly we did. I mean, when Russia moved into the Crimea.
Into Crimea,
You know, and even before that, you know, part of the Ukraine giving up its nuclear stockpile, its deterrent factor is that there was a global promise of support should there be aggression from Russia. Again, what is the purpose of this? You're right, Nick. He legitimized Putin, and he legitimized Putin is weak right now. There's a number of internal issues in Russia, And Trump made him look stronger than he was. And I think he also diminished the Ukraine by the way he's handled the situation. And on a personal note, this has nothing to do with peace or the peace efforts, but the fact that the White House has been turned into sort of an example of modern day brothels is just horrifying to me. I look at the pictures of the gilding that I equate more with the palaces of Versailles than I do with the people's house, and all of these are just little changes of how Trump and the whole movement has warped what we thought about democracy in this country. The point that Teresa and Nick make, though, if I could go back to, because it's really important, we've hollowed out the expertise of this country.
Right.
Okay, we have taken away the idea that this is a meritocracy, and we have gone back to that this is a spoiled system. And the other part of it, and I don't know if we're going to get to be able to talk about the black fence on the border, painting the fence, because it'll be hotter. We have a group of people now in the highest elements of our government who are incompetent and cruel. And they're spending way more time on the cruelty of government than they are in the how to make the country better. And if you've ever asked yourself the question of how did Nazi Germany, devolve into what it was in carrying out the one of the largest mass murders in the history of the world? It was because people not only followed what the leadership said, they amplified it. And what we don't spend a lot of time talking about is the amplification of the move towards authoritarianism by people in the administration and driving out. And I don't know if we're going to talk about Tulsi Gabbard's use of taking away security clearances as a way of firing people because they had the audacity to tell the truth. These stories all hang together in a really grim direction.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Russ writes in and says, it's disheartening to hear the talk of security guarantees for Ukraine. Russia will never allow foreign troops to occupy its renegade province, but would rather mobilize the country in a, quote, patriotic war to repel, quote, the invaders. That from Russ. Panel at WAMC to join the conversation. We'll be back after this news from the BBC. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc here with Teresa Bourgeois, Bob Griffin, and Nick Rangel. We are discussing the Russian-Ukraine war and the meetings that have happened recently about that. Diane writes in and says, leading a company is not governing a country, especially in the United States, the supposed leader of the free world. When you are standing on a stage with the leader of the Soviet Union looking like you're ready to take a nap, it is such a sad state of affairs. Thank God for incredible countries and leaders of those countries who are standing strong with Ukraine. The administration has no idea what they're doing, and unfortunately, it looks like they truly don't care if the bigger picture, let alone the issues at hand. Nick? You don't have to respond to the letter, but you wanted to say something before the break.
Yeah, I guess only so much as kind of hearkening back to our earlier discussion about just the lack of expertise in the White House on these issues. Steve Witkoff is a real estate attorney, and he is the leading envoy and negotiator for peace talks, or I'm air quoting peace talks, between Russia and Ukraine and the United States. And I just, I think that sets us up, that lack of experience in that space specifically sets us up for making these missteps that just shouldn't happen on the national stage as the United States of America.
I'd like to follow on the letter because one of the things I've been thinking about a lot, Trump operates on a news cycle, and Putin and Xi in China and other leaders operate on a long, generational time horizon. And when you look at a lot of what the Trump team is doing is creating these like episodic TV shows. I mean, Trump's success was in his TV show, right? And these are TV shows, and TV shows are wrapped up in nice little, 30-minute or hour-long packages, but it's fake. They're not doing the details, and I'm kind of repeating myself, but a part of the problem here is they don't have the expertise, and they're not truly working through the details to get to solutions to some of these things. And then but it's just driving the news cycle, and we see it in what's happening with the tariffs. We see it's what's happening in D.C. There's a thread here that runs through that's deeply troubling. I'd like to also, this issue of a Nobel Peace Prize, that is a tagline that Trump put out there, and no doubt he maybe really wants it, but his team keeps talking about it. It's much like calling the budget bill the, you know, big beautiful bill. It's putting a label on something where there's nothing real behind it. And if you just, you know, I was looking up something yesterday because there was a court case, a court decision on the blocking the Trump administration blocking USAID funding and other foreign funding, and the judge ruled that they couldn't stop that, not on the merits of the issue, but just on some technical issues. But when I looked at that, a whole series of stories popped up along with it, you know, the related stories. And I thought about this in the context of him thinking that he deserves a Peace Prize. It's U.S. migration chief warns of tighter borders and foreign aid cuts could risk greater instability. Loss of U.S. funding for HIV programs could leave millions dead if not replaced, the UN says. Ghana struggles to fight disease and poverty without vital U.S. aid. In one of Africa's largest refugee camps, food relations are halved as U.S. aid is cut. As U.S. foreign aid drops, United Nations agencies that provide worldwide are slashed their jobs and cut their goals. If you think about just the impact of the aid, USAID cuts around the globe, if you think about what's happening in Gaza and the children starving and thousands of people being killed and the displacement and the, you know, some experts, I'm not an expert, some call it genocide, some call it ethnic cleansing. I'm not sure about the labels, but I am sure that it's totally inappropriate. And where is Trump in that, right? If you look all around the world, I don't know what he's done that would even enable a discussion on this. But again, it's marketing. He's starting marketing his way into something that he does not deserve. And the media and others are going along with it. Even, you know, the diplomats to try to curry favor to keep him from exploding in the White House the other day. You know, it's all part of a plan that's not healthy.
Well, I think that it's an intentional approach to normalizing the behavior that he's been forwarding or advancing since he took office, because, right, we're looking at an administration that it has demonstrated disregard for human rights and international law, yes, has an enhanced military expansion and increased conflict risk in various ways, undermining democratic institution, promoting actual nationalism, right? Like explicitly promoting nationalism, prioritizing personal relationships over diplomatic protocols, which we just talked about, appointing his pals from New York City to these really important and strategic positions, and having an aggressive and disruptive foreign policy, which you're mentioning here in the ways that pulling funding from various U.S.-led initiatives has disrupted and caused famine, starvation, and increase in disease. But also just like his fracturing of international relations very intentionally. And I want to note something I noticed in the meeting with Ukrainian and EU leaders, where he refers to President of France as Emmanuel by the first name for the entire meeting, which I found deeply offensive, instead of referring to people's proper name, their title, and their last name in that meeting. And all of those, to me, are things that he knows he's doing, and he wants the Nobel Peace Prize to whitewash that, right? Like he's trying to jockey for this. Yes, I can be a nationalist. I can be disruptive on the world stage. I can advance disease. I can defund research. I can dismantle our academic institutions and our historical, I guess, like, not just museums, but like what museums stand for, our cultural institutions, right? Yeah. And still get a Peace Prize and still be nominated for it, you know, over and over again. And it's the PR to cleanse all of those behaviors and agenda initiatives.
He's demonstrated a fixation throughout our, you know, exposure to him to desire ratings and prizes, regardless of earning them or past precedents to acquiring them. He's give me the medals. I have the best ratings, etc.
But I think, what you just said was brilliant, that litany. And I would add climate change to that.
Absolutely.
I would add climate change because of the disruption that climate change causes, and for him to walk away from it, to try to disrupt the agreements around it, to go all in on fossil fuels because the industry gave him $1 billion and not understand the short and long term impacts of that, and what the harm. I mean, the Pope has spoken about this, even the harm that climate change is going to cause, the tariffs, the economic disruption that the tariffs are going to cause, and how that's going to that results in, both of those things result in migration in ways that are very dangerous for folks.
I mean, I think those two things are true, but the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded to those who have done the most work or the best work for fraternity between nations, for the abolition or reduction of standing armies, and for holding and promotion of peace congresses. It's awarded for accomplishments that benefit humankind. And while, yes, diminishing or backing off of the initiatives previously in place to at least make some attempts to improve or reduce climate change or the pace of climate change, I think his militaristic and authoritarian policies are more at the center of his Nobel Peace Prize wishes.
It's this self-aggrandizement, right? I mean, this is, I think we're talking about one of, what will go down as one of history's greatest narcissists.
Right.
I also think it's faulty thinking to say that there isn't a plan here. My problem is that I don't understand what the plan is. Okay. But at the same time, these are really smart people. I mean, every domino, Nick, that you just laid out was done purposefully. And yeah, a lot of it can be found in Project 2025. I will say, though, that the implementation of elements of Project 2025 has far exceeded anything that I could have feared. And I think it's actually surprised even the authors of Project 2025. But go into something as simple as bullying through manipulative lawsuits of the media. What has it done? It's backed down a lot of the major mainstream media, where right now I question what I see on places like NBC and CNN. The fact that he took off the board some of the key law firms that would have been a threat to him, because they're the ones that had the best and the brightest that could have gone to court to argue the law and justice. So all of these are, you know, all of these are elements of a plan. My problem with Russia is that I don't understand what the plan is. And this gets me back to the part about his narcissism, but it's also his self-dealing that concerns me. Is that I don't look at anything now that is done by or through the Trump administration without saying, how does he or his family benefit personally, or the people around him benefit personally?
And Bob, I would add to your list his attack on universities, because that has both a domestic and a global impact in terms of the exchange of international students, the investments in research, the leading and so I think that's
And we can talk later after the break.
Panel at WAMC.org. We will return to this conversation after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc here with Teresa Bourgeois, Bob Griffin, and Nick Rangel. Bob.
So sort of wrapping together some of the points that have been made, because I think they're really important. Can we talk just for a second about what does national security really mean? And I worry that we as a country have started to look at national security as the size of our military, the amount of money that we're spending in our military. And we're forgetting, I think, some key doctrinal points that have served this country really well. I remember working with John Kelly when he was the Secretary of Homeland Security before he went over to the White House. And one of the things that Secretary Kelly said that has always struck with me as being completely correct is, if you're depending on a wall at the national border, then your border security has already failed. That the idea of national security is to push the borders as far from the actual physical borders as you possibly can. That's the intent. That was always the intent of things like USAID, international aid, making sure that we had alliances, realizing that the prosperity of other countries helped with the issue of immigration, because if people could live where they were, they would. So all of those elements come together. And as far as the universities that, Teresa, you just raised, it's really important, is let's talk about what we did over the last 100 years with our universities. Our universities became the leaders in the world, that the best and brightest of other countries wanted to come study here. And they did. And they found a welcoming country. They saw the majesty and grandeur of what the country are. They found that the people in the United States were actually nice, that they saw and wanted either their home countries to be like us, or more importantly, wanted to stay here. And you look at what we were able to do as a country is that we were able to attract the best and the brightest, and we kept a lot of them. So I look at, you know, at places like Cambridge, Massachusetts. I look at places like Palo Alto, California. You look at places like Los Angeles, where the students who came from foreign countries that stayed here drove the whole move towards innovation and technology and changes and helping to push the development of this country. These are all part of national security. This is what made us strong. And piece by piece, we're knocking out all of those elements. And you can't talk national security without looking at the totality of it. But what is fundamentally, I think, missed in the current administration is the power of soft power. And soft power is viewed as weak, and to me, it's actually the true strength.
And I absolutely agree with you. And just as an aside, today is the 50th anniversary of Viking 1 being launched from Cape Canaveral and its mission to Mars. The U.S. had the first lander on Mars. That happened a year later. But that happened because of a coalition of investments in between the public sector, the private sector, and universities. And that drove, that is symbolic of the range of innovations and that really have defined the U.S. and defined our role in the world and as you say, drove innovation, which is so important. But I also want to mention a couple of things you said that really triggered some things. One is this issue of where immigration starts and ends. One of the things that the Trump team over and over and over again is harangued Vice President Harris for not going to the border. And because, you know, we're not protecting our borders because she didn't go to the border. Well, what she was doing was working with the countries where immigrants were coming from and seeing, trying to develop ways to strengthen their economies so there wasn't this push-pull to move and work out mechanisms. So doing the hard work of the real issues that are behind this. And the other thing that struck me when you were talking about what is national security, I ask the same question, and I know we'll get it to more, but their approach to what's going on in D.C., and they're going to do the same thing in other cities, where it's a militarized approach as opposed to a broad approach to really getting at the issues of what is what security, what will address the violence problems in our cities. And I had the privilege of working with Mayor Flynn of Boston on the Safe Neighborhoods initiatives, and he was very clear. It was 5% lock them up and 95% everywhere else, and it became a national model what he did. And I think that what you know, as you were describing this global approach, it's the same as their misunderstanding of what's going to work locally. And so they say, well, Democrats don't care about crime when they criticize what they're doing by just putting a bunch of National Guard without any plan, just having a visible show, you know, winning the news cycle. Winning the news cycle is not addressing the problem either in D.C. or globally on these security issues.
Lisa writes in to panel at WAMC.org saying, regarding the Nobel Peace Prize, that Trump has turned the military on its own citizens is or should be disqualifying, giving us a good segue to formally introduce the deployment of National Guard troops in D.C. as a topic this morning. We've, of course, mentioned it a few times, but let us dig in now. The confrontation escalated on Tuesday as a top federal prosecutor in D.C. opened an investigation into whether police officials have falsified crime data, according to a person familiar with the situation who wasn't authorized to comment publicly. A lot of that, of course, going around. The probe could be used to bolster Trump's claims that the city is suffering from a crime emergency despite statistics showing improvements. We have been talking about that element of the story since it was announced last week. National Guard members from West Virginia, South Carolina, Mississippi, and Louisiana began arriving in Washington yesterday to assist in the crackdown, according to Joint Task Force District of Columbia, the military unit overseeing the D.C. Guard. From his actions and remarks, Trump seems interested in ratcheting up the pressure. His administration has asked Republican-led states to send more National Guard troops, a total of 1,100 on top of the 800 from the D.C.-based Guard. In addition to those states whose deployments started arriving yesterday, Ohio and Tennessee have also said they will send forces. This action taking place in D.C., of course, we're concerned about it spreading to other cities in the United States. At least those of us in this room are I would say, worried is the word for it, and find it likely imminent. Bob.
So many issues here. This has nothing to do with crime. Okay, let's talk crime for a second. I looked at some crime statistics before I came on the show. Generally, depending on how you count crime and crime statistics, let me give you the top 10 cities with the highest crime rates. Memphis, Tennessee is number one, which is ironic because Tennessee is going to send their National Guard units to D.C. when their own cities have the highest crime. Okay. Detroit, St. Louis, Baltimore, Cleveland, Birmingham, New Orleans. There we go again. Little Rock, Kansas City, Milwaukee. Seven out of the top 10 cities with crime issues are in red states. All right, if we're going to talk crime, okay, I would also argue that the same way the military has absolutely failed in state building, this is part of the problem that we've seen in the Ukraine, in Afghanistan, excuse me. It's not what they do well, okay? That's not what they're trained to do. Okay, so this idea that we're going to use the military to do all of these other things is setting us up for failure. this is in my mind, if we ever do get elections and can change administrations, this is a clear case on why D.C. needs a statehood. Okay, the reason they are able to, and the administration is able to throw its weight around the way it is because of status as a federal city. It is going to be much more difficult in the states because of the Constitution, although they've been pretty quick in ignoring the Constitution when they've wanted to. Although, Teresa, I think that we do face a time where the military will be used, particularly as we get closer to elections, and elections seem like they're going against the current administration.
Biggest fear I have.
Yep.
Trying to normalize the use of military on the cities, streets of our cities. Posse comitatus. Can't do it. Not constitutional, but they're trying to normalize it.
Which is fascinating to me because the point is so valid, and the concern is so interesting to me is that the concern on the right about the loss of freedom. You know, I remember a time when FEMA was just doing disaster exercises, and it was being viewed with skepticism as a governmental takeover. This is truly a governmental takeover. And what's happened in the streets of D.C., because I've been talking to folks down there, is there's fear on the streets, there's anger. The vibrant restaurant scene, arts, culture, tourism, it's choking the life out of the city, which then is going to be used as an excuse as the failure of the cities. And remember, Trump has been playing this game about the cities being blue and therefore deserve this crackdown, this loss of freedoms. But let me turn it over to the other panelists because there's a lot more we need to talk about with
this. I think for timing, it makes more sense to break now and come back to everything. So keep your thoughts, hold them firm in your memories, and we will absolutely discuss this more after a newscast. The panel this morning, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Bob Griffin, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. We will return to the roundtable panel after a legal ID, some underwriting, and news with David Gustina. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc here with public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Bob Griffin, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. Before our news break, we were discussing the presence of the National Guard in D.C., what that could mean for the future, what is happening now, the implications therein. We're going to expand the conversation to how the effects of the Trump administration are impacting our local cities, et cetera. But Nick Rangel, I cut you off before the break. What would you like to talk about regarding this now?
I just wanted to note that, so Bob was mentioning some of the highest crime rates in the United States are in other cities, not D.C., and D.C. is not even anywhere near top cities. But what I want to remark on is that in many, if not most of those cities, and I haven't gone through all 10, but domestic violence is a huge share of the violent crimes being reported. More than half of the violent crimes in Memphis, Tennessee, which is the number one most violent city in the country, more than half of those violent crimes are domestic violence crimes. And so when we're like, why would we spend so much time thinking about Washington, D.C. instead of these other cities that have high crime rates? I do think there's a conversation around how much we value or intentionally consider domestic violence as part of those crime rates. And our interest as a country in tackling domestic violence issues as opposed to other sources of crime, which is the center of the administration's interest in D.C. So the administration's interest in D.C. is, right, they've said youth offenders, gangs in air quotes, drug use in air quotes, these types of crimes, carjackings, assaults, these types of crimes that they can pull out from those statistics of violent violence in the city as opposed to other sources of crime that have higher homicide rates, like domestic violence, right? Or rates that include gun violence, like domestic violence and intimate partner violence. And we know that that's not a priority because they've been defunding those programs across the country. They are rolling back gun restrictions. They announced yesterday, I don't, the days are
this
all
week,
one.
Yesterday.
Sometime recently, that they won't be prosecuting certain kinds of gun possessions. And statistically, we know that when there's a gun in the household, there's a much higher chance of a domestic violence incident resulting in a homicide or a violent crime, right? Like, these things we know, and yet this administration is very intentionally moving away from the progress that had been made to tackle those, like, underlying problems. And I just want to say that because we keep talking about, well, violent crimes are not as high, and it's because we aren't talking about domestic violence and intimate partner violence.
But it's also the interrelationship between a lot of these issues, Sarah, that I don't want to lose track of, right? Mm-hmm. That at the same time, there's this narrative that's coming out, particularly from the GOP, about cities being unsafe, okay, and creating this climate of fear. When you look at the budget priorities, What we're doing is we're actually stripping resources away from the elements that actually would have helped people. And, you know, I would go back to Nick we had a conversation before the show that was just fascinating to me, because talking about what's going on with the nonprofit sector and the cuts that are coming from the federal government, and the cuts that have been made both legally and illegally by the administration have an enormous impact, but there's a long runway before people really feel it. And everyone's like, well, look, you know, all of these cuts really haven't affected anybody yet. And I'm going to go back to Nick to talk about sort of how these things roll out, but we haven't felt the impact of these cuts yet on services the way we are going to. But the analogy I use is that the water isn't in the pipe right now. And the house is on fire, and the water's not going to be there, so the fire is going to get worse. Nick, do you mind talking a little bit about what you're seeing in the nonprofit community and sort of these cuts and what's happening?
Yeah, of course. So I want to just start with cities and counties across the state do a point-in-time count of homeless families. And a year ago, the point-in-time count for this period was 93 homeless families in Albany County, and it's up to 158 homeless families in the county. The number of homeless families is increasing dramatically, as noted. There were 158 sheltered families last year, one unsheltered, and 92 sheltered households with children. This year, there are 260 children in shelter. Last year, it was 191 children. This year, there's 182 adults with children in shelter. Last year, it was 106 adults with children. This year, there was one chronically homeless family, which last year there wasn't. They were able to find stability, right? And this is one of many indicators that poverty rates, homelessness, these destabilizing conditions are increasing. And this is in upstate New York and in Albany, right? So what we're seeing across the country is, as federal funding pauses extend even beyond one payroll cycle for a small nonprofit that has no margin or cushion of their funding source, those small organizations, community-based organizations, are already starting to close across the country. The need that they were addressing is lost to the community. And even if the funding has been restored because the pause has been struck down by whatever court, that organization's already laid off all their staff. They've already released their lease on their property. They've already closed down shop. They've let go of all their board of directors. They're done. They don't just pop up overnight. And in states like New York, there is more of a cushion, but many organizations are already facing staffing cuts. They are losing grants. They're ending programs that those grants were funding. That includes domestic violence grants from the federal government, HUD funding from the federal government. We know that food pantries are saddling in, I guess, for like significant cuts to the SNAP programs. And that's without, that's just the administrative pauses, the delays caused by agency layoffs and changes in priorities, the closure of offices because of the intention of this administration to defederalize those types of services, and the reconciliation bill. And now we're all looking to the federal budget, which, if you were reviewing the president's recommendations, would slash and burn the vast majority of our social safety net. His proposal is a full defunding of Legal Services Corporation. It's a full defunding of many housing, homelessness, food, and family programs. It's a deep cut to domestic violence and crime victims funding, and many other programs. And, you know, many organizations are kind of facing this existential threat to our very existence. And that, we know statistically, leads to higher crime rates, because poverty leads to higher crime rates. Right. The lack of access to not just jobs, but food for children, health services, child care, so that people can go to those jobs. And so we're like setting ourselves up for this idea that high crime exists in cities, because we're going to create the poverty that triggers those crime rate increases. And then, as Teresa pointed out, that will legitimize the use of military force to handle those crime rates.
And for proclivity to think about martial law in a way that should be politically untenable for anybody in elected office, this is definitely playing into what could potentially be the next few years of our life. And the self-fulfilling prophecy, and Nick, thank you for talking about this. You know, I want to think about the secondary and tertiary waves of this. As these nonprofits are closing the doors, people are losing their services. We know that's going to have an impact on crime. We're not talking about things like the overall economy and the fact that people who still have their jobs are less likely to spend money. So if you're thinking about what's going on in the housing market, I mean, there is a malaise on this country right now that is significant and underreported. And when it is being reported, the people who are telling the truth are getting their heads chopped off. And if you're killing the messenger because they're telling the truth, guess what happens? The messenger isn't going to be telling you the truth. So all of this is, you know, do I sound grim? Yeah, because this is grim. And let me sort of focus some of my concerns. One, I have never in my history trusted the military leadership less than I do right now. Mm-hmm. I've never in my long history, particularly with law enforcement, had more doubts about law enforcement than I do right now. The idea that it is supported by anybody in a position of authority to allow for masked, unidentified police officers to pull people off streets as a good thing is absolutely anathema to everything that I'm about. But as a member of the community, I see it in little ways. I see a police officer, you know, running radar, and I think, are they going to follow the law? I mean, it breaks down my basic compact, our institutional compacts, in ways that I think weaken the country in ways that Putin couldn't. And again, I want to go back to the very early part of the show where we started to talk about Putin and Trump, and to look at Putin's control over Trump. Just look at Putin makes some comment about mail-in ballots, and Trump wants to change exactly how everybody is doing, having access to the ballot box in ways that only an authoritarian would.
Can I, just on that point, because you made a point earlier about the crime statistics and questioning the D.C. crime statistics, and I think that is part of a larger disinformation campaign, and there's nothing else that you can call it's a disinformation campaign. Questioning the crime statistics, questioning the validity of mail-in balloting, questioning the validity of the Bureau of Labor Statistics data. All of these things, and they do this with no basis in fact, but as a tool to confuse people, a tool to counter the narrative of what's actually happening. This is all part of a larger disinformation campaign, and we've got to cut into that messaging, just like we've got to cut into the messaging of Big Beautiful Bill or Nobel Peace Prize for all of the wonderful ways that Nick had pointed out that it's, you know, there's no foundation there for that, because it really does whittle away at one's faith in these institutions, which they are trying to break down people's faith in these institutions. It's part of a larger goal that's very, very dangerous for the framework of our democracy. But also,
Teresa, we have a national brainworm right now. I mean, right. Think about just the irony that people are taking medical advice from RFK Jr. and they think that Fauci didn't know what he was talking about. I mean, you put your finger on something that I think is hugely problematic, where the narrative is you can't trust the experts, and therefore anybody who has the loudest megaphone is an expert now. And we know
Harvard,
that's
you can't
case.
Trust Harvard. You can't trust the scientists. You can't trust the experts and historians. You know, they want to rewrite history. They are attacking expertise, and they are causing Americans to doubt. They are attacking, you know, the woman who led the Bureau of Labor Statistics. By all accounts, she was a very fine, highly qualified, apolitical public servant,
yeah.
Right? And there are global implications, global economic implications for attacking her. But they did it because it served their purposes, because that day they had bad numbers. But they will risk shifting global economics, because globally there's a dependence on these statistics. I mean, people may not realize it. It may seem like I'm overstating it, but I'm not overstating it. It's important. But also, if you look at shifting a little bit here, but if you look at the full-scale, broad-based economic attack that the Trump administration has made on the District of Columbia, this, what they're doing now is so dangerous and so absurd and so abhorrent. So first of all, when they passed the continuing resolution in March, one of the things they did is, because they didn't make a change in the budget, this is wonky, but they ended up freezing over $1 billion in D.C.'s funding. So the mayor and the government doesn't have access to over $1 billion. This is $1 billion for law enforcement, for homelessness services, for water treatment, for a whole range of things, because when they have a continuing resolution, you revert back to the previous budget. The D.C. is considered, treated like a federal agency, but they're not a federal agency, so there's a standard one-line fix that they put in a budget. And on the Republican House side, they refused, they did it on purpose inadvertently, but they've refused to fix it. They fixed it on the Senate side. I mean, that may seem a lot of detail, but they've blocked them from spending $1 billion, two-thirds of which is from taxpayers from D.C. So it's just sitting there. So $1 billion loss off the top in their budget. 160,000 of the 700,000 residents of D.C. were federal workers. So you slash federal workers, you've created an economic problem in the city. Plus all the people that were not from the city who are federal workers are not coming in working there. You've now hurt small businesses because they're not coming in. They're not getting the tax base. That's another economic assault on the city. You have frozen funds to all the things that Nick talked about, all the range of ways that funds have been frozen.
consultants who are there frozen, another economic. The tariffs, they raise food prices, that's another economic assault. So you have these range of economic assaults that hurt their ability to do all sorts of things, address homeless issues, do law enforcement. And that all adds up to a very strained effort of which they are working their way through. And then you come in having had these economic assaults on the community, and let's not forget January 6th. You know, you want to talk about assaults on a community. January 6th was the worst on 140 police officers. But you have these economic assaults on big business, small business. You hurt them economically. You hurt their ability to provide services. You freeze their funding. They know on the horizon are these deep cuts in funding. And then you say, you're not doing your job. We've got to come on and fix it. They accelerated and exacerbated the problem that they say they're now going to fix. And their fix is all law enforcement in not an organized way. And this is a pattern that they're going to do in other places. It's rhetorical, but it's not addressing the problem. If they want to address the problem, there are ways to get law enforcement to do that.
Speaking of undermining, let's introduce to the conversation a story that came over the news yesterday about stripped security clearances. The Trump administration said it was revoking the security clearances of 37 current and former national security officials in the latest act of retribution targeting public servants from the federal government's intelligence community. This summary from the AP. A memo from the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, accused the singled out individuals of having engaged in, quote, the politicization and weaponization of intelligence to advance personal or partisan goals, failing to safeguard classified information, failing to adhere to professional analytic tradecraft standards, and other unspecified detrimental conduct. The memo did not offer evidence to back up the accusations. Many of the officials who were targeted left the government years ago after serving in both senior national security positions and lower profile roles far from the public eye. Some worked on matters that have long infuriated Trump, like the intelligence community assessment that Russia interfered in the 2016 presidential election on his behalf. And several signaled their concerns about Trump by signing a critical letter in 2019 that was highlighted on social media last month by right-wing provocateur and close Trump ally Laura Loomer. The action is part of a broader Trump administration campaign to wield the levers of government against perceived adversaries and reflects the president's continued distrust of career intelligence officials that he has long seen as working against his interests. Bob.
Yeah, it's we're looking at the actions of what I would have said is a wannabe dictator. Now, unfortunately, I think he's in a position to do a lot of what he wants to do. And anybody who questions Trump or is perceived to tell the truth that is questioning of Trump, you know, like the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it's off with their heads. And in the IC community, this is really important for, especially for folks that have security clearances. That is your, if the way you fire folks in the IC community is you take away their security clearances, because then you can't work on any documentation that is secure. So,
for those who don't know, what's the IC community?
So the intelligence community is folks that are dealing with classified, top secret, or even above data. It's the analysts that are working both domestically and internationally. They're dealing with everything from terrorism to international global affairs. I mean, it's the backbone of what should be shaping our foreign policy and shaping our policy. So the intelligence community is throughout multiple different agencies, because there's different needs in different elements of data that's coming in. So this idea of well, you know, these folks are, you know, just being stripped of their security clearances. True. But once you strip somebody of their security clearances, you know, how do they get that back? How do you bring them into future administrations? You also have this challenge of these folks gave the best assessment that they could give. Okay, it doesn't mean that it's always right, but this is part of the beauty of having diversity in your intelligence community. You know, one of the taglines I use with my own college is that the diversity in DEI isn't just a moral imperative; it's a national security imperative. The idea that you have other voices around the table that looks at data differently. That's why making sure that we have folks that are coming from different backgrounds and different approaches is so important, because it helps make sure that there isn't blind spots.
We'll return to this topic after news from the BBC. You're listening to The Roundtable. Welcome to the final segment of the Roundtable panel for this morning. I'm Sarah LaDuke, here with Teresa Bourgeois, Bob Griffin, and Nick Rangel. Before the newscast, we're discussing security clearances being stripped by the Trump administration from 37 officials. Teresa.
I just want to pick up on the issue of the security clearances, because, yes, that is terrible. And they are, it's projection, you know, they are weaponizing the government against these folks, and they are doing, you know, they are blaming others for doing what they do. But I'm more concerned about the broader issue of hollowing out the national security expertise in this country. And Bob, I think you'd be better to speak on the facts of that. But across the board there, and starting with Tulsi Gabbard, right, there have been cuts in pullback and reductions and forcing people out in the national security space. And so what does that mean for our safety, and what does that mean for our interaction with our allies, who see what's happening with national security, see how loosey-goosey the Trump administration is with national security information, and worry about exchange of information? Fewer people, less confidence.
Yeah, and you know, there are a couple of issues here. One is that for all intent and purposes, between DOGE, the administration's efforts to hunt down anyone that disagrees with them, the fact that they're actively publicly killing the messengers who are simply giving the best intelligence analysis that they can give, they're purging. I mean, and frankly, I will use the term specifically in this case. You know, they've purged a number of the top generals. They have purged a number of the top intelligence community leaders and analysts. They have put in folks that are either unqualified, underqualified, or are simply there because of their political beliefs, not what is right or good for the country. And the intelligence community across the globe is a tight-knit group that really works on built and shared trust. It's like when analysts would be working with each other, it was over decades of work, and they've broken a lot of those bonds. If you're an analyst in you know the United Kingdom or Germany or Australia, I think you're going to be less likely to be upfront and open sharing with this country right now, given the fact that we are no longer viewed as a good partner. So all of these elements play towards a continued weakening of our national security, which is a theme that we've gone to a couple of times today. Putin couldn't have done more to destroy this country than he has by just supporting Donald Trump. I mean, he couldn't militarily have destroyed more of our government and our critical infrastructures than he has through active war than he has by figuring a way to get into the ear of Donald Trump and steer him the way that no American president should ever have let a Russian leader do.
Nick Rangel, opinions your own?
Opinions my own, always. I think stripping access to fact-based, data-backed information to provide clear, neutral analysis to members of Congress, to other security experts, people who need to have enough information to make good, sound decisions and determinations allows the administration to further silo and close off its work from the public, from the American people. And I think that as the grip on information gets tighter, the more difficult it is for the rest of us to get a handle on what's going on internally and in the world, right? And I think we've talked about national security as being weakened, but it's because we are chipping away at the sources of information and the access of that information to the experts who would know what to do with it, right? If you are a person who is a data analyst and you don't have access to the hard numbers, how are you going to evaluate the strategy that the administration is using to achieve its goals? And I think, you know, it kind of goes back to our dismantling of like academia and thinking about, you know, who are the experts in the room and how are they going to lead us into the future if they can't even access basic information about what's going on to and among the United States. And I think that's really troubling.
Can I say, a lot of what we've talked about today, I think, is troubling, right? And if I were a listener, I think, oh, my God, just shut off the radio. This is too much. But the question is always, well, what can we do? What can we do?
Don't tell them to shut off the radio.
Don't shut off the radio. Don't shut off the radio. Build a community.
But not on National Radio Day.
No, don't shut off the radio. We need it. We need to have these conversations. But I do think it's important when we have these conversations, we have some conversation that gets people thinking about what they can do. Mm-hmm. And we are going into the final part of the budget season right now. And all of this is driven by resources, right? And there are going to be decisions that are made between now and October 1st, when the new fiscal year begins, about what gets funded, how it gets funded. And it's still the purview of the House and Senate members who serve you, you know, our elected officials, to make those decisions. And so now is a very good time to pick your lane, whatever issue it is that you're most expertise in or care about or affects your community, and make sure that your member of Congress and your senator know where you stand on this and that these are funded in the right way, because a lot of what we're talking about now is really shaped by this will be shaped whether or not they can continue on the path. It's going to be shaped on the budget. And the Russ Vogt, the director of OMB, Office of Management and Budget, just released some proposals yesterday to give the president much more power to control the flow of all grants and all these fundings and down to a granular level to be able to stop it and take it out of the hands of the agencies. But that's up to Congress, and it's up to the vote. So far, the Republicans have not maintain their power. But I think that the public is speaking more and more. I think what's going on in Texas with the Republicans to try to do redistricting is a real show of fear, not strength, but fear and weakness on the part of the Republicans who see that the public is turning against them. And I think that if, in fact, you are concerned about this, it's time to turn up the volume, particularly in the next 4 weeks as they go into this budget cycle.
Yeah, and Tracy, I think you put your finger on as much as I dislike Trump and members of his administration, I think I'm angrier at Congress right now, and I will say that collectively, they have turned their back on their fiduciary responsibilities to the taxpayers, the people in this country. So much of what is being done right now is being done under so-called emergency powers, because Congress hasn't stepped up and done what they should have done. So they're enabling the bureaucracy under Trump and the Trump administration to basically run rampant through our laws and through the streets of our cities
in unconstitutional ways.
In unconstitutional ways, the fact that the speaker adjourned the House early, that's a sign of weakness. And you say, well, you know, what can we do about all of this grimness? When our legislators, when our members of Congress do show up to events, show up and let them know how angry you are. I applaud what happened up in Plattsburgh The fact that we have a sitting member of Congress who hasn't held a town hall in a number of years is frankly, in my mind, they shouldn't hold their position if they're not going to talk to their constituents. And if you're afraid of the people, then you're in the wrong business. But Congress is not doing what they should be doing. So not only is the budget coming up, it's the election.
Right.
And that what's going on in Texas right now is a naked power grab to try to strip power from the rest of us who are following the rules and norms. But this next election coming up in midterm is critically important, and you got to keep the heat on these people. You got to keep the heat on these elected representatives that are not doing their jobs.
I don't want to step on it, but.
Well, I was just nodding. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, and I think as Teresa started earlier with, we need to be doing more to build community. There are ways to support things like public radio and journalism and free press. And there are ways to support legal services. There's ways to support the causes that are near and dear to us that, you know, make our community stronger and in a better position to stand up for themselves. And I think back to, let's take what's happening in Texas with redistricting. There are so many things that are impacting people's daily lives that it is making it more difficult for them to participate politically beyond themselves. And I think, you know, in a different universe, people in Texas would be upset that redistricting is happening to them in this manner without their consent or permission or support. But we're not seeing as much of that on the ground outrage as I think the time calls for. And I think, you know, as things heat up, these other budget cuts and initiatives become more egregious and in our face, but people still are not recognizing racial profiling for what it is, right? People are still not quite changing their tune. The people who voted for this administration in the last election are not leaving the party in droves, right? They are still okay with what's happening, even if their approval ratings are low. There is still a lot of support in the administration and in the party. And like, until that really starts to shift, the continued militarization of our cities, these other really flashy, in-your-face things are also going to continue to increase.
We are out of time for this morning. Thank you for being here. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, thank you. Thank you to the Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Bob Griffin. Thanks, Bob. And Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. Thank you, Nick. We have a broadcast coming up. WAMC On the Road presents the Adirondack Roundtable Trade and Tourism in the Park on Monday, September 8th, 9 to noon at the High Peaks Resort in Lake Placid, New York. It is our first co-production with our friends in the North Country at North Country Public Radio. To learn more, visit wamc.org/WAMC On the Road. The roundtable continues after this.